Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as every week, I'll be actually helping to take us both out to the big picture, but to into the up close and personal and toward a world of desirable futures, those rich, of course, with the essence of constant renewal. Well, it's great to be back again here in our beautiful studio on the bay, joining the Gulf of Mexico. And fortunately, all here is still pristine and immaculate, with sugary white sand beaches and clear oil-free water. We have actually been spared the frontline impact of the Gulf spill. We have been spared from the up-close and personal experience and grief of seeing oil and tar balls on our beaches. But, of course, others in the panhandle of Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana have not. And that will be the subject of next week's show. Our filmmaking colleagues are, as we speak today, beginning an on-site tour and with an exploration into the human and societal tolls that have been exacted by the Deepwater Horizon spill. Next week, we're going to be talking about realities of lives there, about perspectives on the commons, which is a frequent topic on Zoomed, and we'll be talking about what might be needed, at least on a beginning basis, to better manage and sustain the Gulf Commons for the future. But today, my mind continues on the Gulf, certainly as a context beyond the spill, perhaps, but with a background recognition for this show of the continuing, perhaps, expansion of the dead zone phenomenon that occurs in the Gulf year after year, in addition to what we've been experiencing with this oil situation. Agricultural runoff in the form of fertilizer and pesticides flows into the Mississippi River, comes from the farm belt of the U.S. directly into the Gulf, and it brings with it a huge seasonal oxygen-starved dead zone that has erupted certainly year after year, but in coverage most recently about the size of Massachusetts, another 8,000 miles in measurement about 2 years ago, where the fish and other marine life must flee this zone as well as the oil, or they will perish. The impacts of the combined spill, then, the dead zone we're talking about, the Deepwater Horizon spill, has to be a huge concern to us all, no matter where we live, no matter whether you're on the Gulf or anywhere else. And why? Because I think this situation reflects a foundational human view, particularly here in the West, but a worldview in general that is one-sided, perhaps narrowly self-absorbed, but absent of a larger picture or degree of reciprocity that might be called for in our thinking to realize sustainable futures that we talk about. This orientation to reciprocity, what indigenous communities have termed AYNI, A-Y-N-I, is the subject of our conversation today. Our show title is Earth-Centered Wisdom, and it reflects the notion that there are perspectives and principles and indigenous ways of living that are important for us to consider, to recognize, and really to sense into. And in some ways, they might offer what I often refer to as the back of life, but the foundations that could fuel the front of life, change needed, and the perspective about managing the Gulf as a commons. My guest today, deeply experienced and versed in AYNI and indigenous wisdom, is Dr. James E. Williams, a pioneer in integrative and naturopathic medicine, internationally recognized author. He's an author of 5 books, including the Andean Codex, and the man that many, I think, will call the Indiana Jones of natural medicine. James has experience with more than 20 indigenous tribes in North and South America. He's explored the development of communities in Cuba and China. And, of course, Cuba serves as a microcosm example through their special 5-year period back in the late 80s and into the 90s of what a post-peak oil world might resemble. all of his distinguished background, I think you'll find today, his clinical and deep shamanic training have combined to illuminate some essential transformation perspectives for the future, which we welcome on Zoomed. James, absolutely great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so very, very much. It's a pleasure, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, let's get started, James. I think one of the things that people read about in the show flow and description of it is that you have such a rich background in these different indigenous communities coupled with your training. But they started you at a very young age, and maybe you can give us a sense of that. It started in the Arctic even and has progressed from there. Maybe you can start and just give us a sense, James, of this flow of experience and a very rich life.
Well, thank you very much. One of the things I think is very important about, you know, who I am and my work and why I have this perspective is that I was raised in the country. I was raised on a real old-fashioned working New England farm. So I spent lots of time in the woodlands and in the fields and pastures, and I'm not an urbanite who trying to reconnect to the nature. I was always there. And I was a very bright student and graduated high school early. And at 17 years old, I was enrolled and started studying at the University of Alaska. Then it was in Fairbanks, or outside of Fairbanks, in a little town called College, Alaska. And shortly thereafter, I connected with some of the Native American students there, the two populations being different types of Eskimo people and Indian people. And mainly I was gravitated towards the Eskimo, and within a very short time, by 1968, I was living with them in the village of Savunga, St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea, 35 miles from the Kamchatka Peninsula. It used to be the Soviet Union, you know, part of the evil empire, you know, that's no longer exists. But at that time, there was absolutely nothing there, other than walrus and humpback whales and a few scattered villages of very traditional people, Savunga being considered by anthropologists being the most traditional village left in the entire Alaskan Bering Sea and Alaskan Arctic. And I had the privilege of being adopted, given a name, and living with them for nearly a year. I committed the mortal sin at the time for an academic, which was I went native. I threw out my tape recorder and notebooks and just dived into the experience, because I realized very quickly that you couldn't get anything unless you became one of them. So I started there in 67 and 68 and progressed to all types of connections with indigenous and native people, and particularly in Latin America. Spanish fluent doesn't help too much when they don't speak Spanish in the remote tribal groups. But in the last 14 years, I've been concentrating on a very remote group of indigenous people, the Caro, Q-apostrophe-R-O, in the Andes south of Cusco, the high mountains. They live at 14,000 to 16,000 feet. Traverse passes as high as 18,000, even 19,000 feet, and considered the last ancestors of the Incas. There would be almost no contact at all with the outside world up until the year 2000.
And James, that's really what you're painting here, is a picture that I really relish myself personally in coming to know you, and I think in terms of our conversation, because you have that inside perspective of not just sort of looking out as an outside-in scientist, but you brought the sophistication of your practice here in the States and the Western world, but really intermesh that with a livingness inside these communities to experience the flavor and feel of what they're about, the nature of their living, their style, their connection with the earth, the wisdom that pervades that. That, to me, is a compelling view that really bridges this conversation in a very rich way. And so I'm delighted to have you on here. But what is that like? I mean, you've got really one foot in, one foot over there, but we've talked about it. When you're there, you're really in it, and it's quite an extraordinary experience.
Yes, you you know, in the beginning, you have to gain their confidence, and there's two things. You have to be willing to live like they live, and meaning, you know, I eat their food. I don't bring any power bars or anything like that with me, and I eat exactly what they eat, and I sleep exactly how they sleep. You know, that's on the ground, on, in this case, alpaca skins and things like that. I travel with them exactly how they travel, by foot, and they do have some horses which they brought in by the, you know, the conquistadors hundreds of years ago, of course they have llamas and alpacas, the llama being the burden there. They carry small amounts, but most of it is just on your back, you know, on your own feet, in these extraordinarily remote areas, high altitude, and the pure wilderness. And if anything happens, nobody's coming in to get you. There's no way to get communication out. I don't carry radios or anything like that. I do 100% totally their way. And then little by little, they come to understand you. You live closely with them. You're intimately. And then you have to show your fortitude. You have to show your strength and your courage. There's no room for, you know, for whining. And no matter how cold it gets, no matter how much you ache and hurt, you can't. And as I get older, it's not comfortable. I was younger, still was uncomfortable, but you know, you can handle it. And with the Eskimos, we hunted in skin boats that, you know, handmade from walrus skin by the traditional women who were tattooed their faces, every joint on their body, their backs, their breasts. All done by hand, all scraped by hand and sewn by hand, steel gut. If you can imagine going in water, that is 4 minutes, you're dead if you fall in, so cold, and hunting walrus with that are the size of elephants and, you know, huge tusks and these flimsy type boats. But you have to do everything the way they do. You have to show your ability and your fortitude, and then little by little they start to open up. So it takes a minimum of 4 to 5 years. Then, you know, usually about the eighth year they start to really accept you.
And James, that's really what I was hoping we could do. You've painted a marvelous picture here, sort of the texture and the nuance in that, but it is from that inside perspective that I think is useful for us to frame the recognition. And we come back, I'd like to hear more and like to begin to get a sense, and helps paint the picture for our audience about Aini, the nature of reciprocity, this principle of sustainability. What is it? It's something to learn from that we are not connected to all here in the West. That's the conversation. That's where we continue. Let's take a break, folks. We hear the music in our ears. Come back. Dr. James Williams with us today on this Monday. Got a long place to go. It's going to be fun today. Come back in a minute.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Classes in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoomed on this Monday. It is absolutely brilliant as I look out here on the bay today. I really get it in my body, the nature of the Gulf and our conversation about the nature of the wisdom that really will help bring this context of care and responsibility to the nature of the Gulf. But that's our focus today. Context of our show is earth-centered, earth-based wisdom. Our guest, Dr. James Williams, author of Andean Codex, really bringing forward his rich Western background in integrative and naturopathic medicine with his inside perspective of living in and with indigenous communities, learning more about this. James, I teased up before the break this word, Aini, A-Y-N-I, and perhaps to many, and perhaps even to the world, this might be a new word that really is just so embedded in the culture there. Maybe you can introduce this to us, give a sense of the word, what it means, the fabric of it.
Aini is a Quechua word from the Incan Empire that still spoke by Native people throughout the Andes from Ecuador to Chile and northern Argentina, Peru, Bolivia. Peru being having the largest concentration of Quechua speakers of all of those countries. And it means reciprocity. That's the basic meaning. However, it goes much, much deeper. And I'd like to drill down a little bit into that right now. And
yeah, please do.
Share that with your listeners is that it has to do with the interchange of humanness, of loving-kindness, of knowledge, the fruits of one's labor, and that the purpose of reciprocity is the maintenance of life. It's not just a give and take, which is an important part what happens with when I help you and tomorrow you help me. That's the basis of Aenean practice. However, the purpose of reciprocity is the maintenance of life, and that life is interconnected with the natural world. So Aini reminds us that all of life is worthy of our reverence, our respect, and that we have a universal responsibility to every living thing on earth. And that is what I discovered among all indigenous people in the New World and finding it in other traditional cultures as well, is their ability to endure, evolve over thousands of years, not hundreds of years like we're talking about in modern capitalistic driven countries, but thousands of years, has been based upon one universal principle, sustainability. I believe that we can recapture that, rediscover that, and use it as an ethical and moral compass, a golden compass, so to speak, one that we've lost and have forgotten about, and but they have not, from them, regained centered wisdom.
James, in my own being, I did use kind of the notion of give and take, and on one level, a very surface level, you're describing that that's part of it, a little like the golden rule that you do and treat others in that way, but you're really describing a very much deeper connectedness and integration of life, and certainly with life, including the natural world, that worthiness of respect, but you're really getting to a sense of responsibility. And that really is a rich perspective. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that and the nature of that and how that plays out. How do they live that in these indigenous communities in this world of sustainability that seems to be in the fabric of who they are?
They first are responsible as human beings to and they're taught from childhood and model after the elders that the human is a part of the body of natures. The greater picture of that, the living earth is termed Pachamama. So they don't see us as ants running across the ground. They see us as integral, intimate parts of Pachamamas or the earth's body, so that we are embedded in and same time, because we are the conscious beings, we are responsible for our thoughts, our actions, our behavior, and that extends not just to our immediate family, the tribal group, the community, and like-minded individuals, but to all living things, including animals, plants, and as well as natural phenomena like the weather, the lightning, the thunder, and that when something is given to you from the earth, if you are to take, for example, some plants for healing, we always offer a gift. Every time we take a drink, even of water, we pour a little bit to the earth. And with this in our hearts, thinking, earth first, Mama, I am here, as a humble human being, and help me to remember you. Help me to understand your ways of wisdom. Help me to be a better human being. Help me to be ethical in my business and to be successful, so I can help others. And that web of interconnectivity is to them, through their eyes, is seamless. And anywhere that you touch on that web vibrates every part of that web. What you want is to find a touch that provides resonance throughout the web of life.
So I'm hearing here that there's not a separateness, but at the same time that the natural world is not much like we often hear and see and live in the modern world, where nature is a resource to be used to satisfy the wants and the technological movements and the progression of humanity, but it's there separate from us. And what you're describing is something rich here. It's an integrated fabric and a oneness of life, James, that really is a compelling lived experience within these peoples. How would they, I'm curious, how would they and how do they experience when they have you've seen and they've experienced different devastation to their parts of life and the natural world there, and just thinking about the Gulf as an example, how does that actually play out? How do they physically experience and emotionally sense into that? What's there? How do they feel about that?
Well, they feel terrible about it, in a way that it's almost inexplicable to us, because they're so traditional people. Talking about, they're so intimately connected that they feel it in their bones, in their marrow, in their it's a cellular thing. It's an ancestral thing that there's disharmony. There's no reverence. They see us as overwhelming the earth of rich crazy people doing abominable things to the sacred earth, and and they're shocked and horrified, and they historically what they've done is they, among other many other things, you know, they retreat, and they retreat into enclaves, and Peru has been blessed, I call it the, you know, the biological Noah's Ark of our times, as being remote and kind of for a long time a forgotten country almost, but to have all the Earth's climate systems in one country, many microclimates and lots of wilderness and in very inaccessible places. So different groups have been able to isolate themselves in small communities and in the upper Amazon and the southern part of the Andes, right up until modern times, until the last even 5-10 years. However, even that now is disappearing, and they sense change of weather. They see the rain patterns being very disrupted, so that the climates seasonal changes are not falling on what they're traditionally used to. So it's very hard for them to time their planting of their potatoes and other crops, and they see the melting of the glaciers and the permanent snow caps on the high mountains, which are now down to about 60% in equatorial permanent snow-capped mountains across the planet. And some of them are almost completely gone. Year by year, they're disappearing. Now, that is a reservoir of water. These countries, Peru, as well as those in Africa and in Pakistan and India and even parts of China. So when that ice cover is reduced, it doesn't have to be completely gone, but it's reduced to a certain level, and that's starting to happen, then there's not enough flowing water, the rain patterns change, and their crops can't produce enough crop to feed themselves. So they have to migrate out of those territories. Then they run into a clash. There's no place left to go to hide. Then they clash with modern society. Usually, they're going to be extraordinarily marginalized fall right into abject poverty, disease, prostitution, and this is what I'm working with now with our nonprofit work in Peru and other places to develop a model of more ethical, healthier transition for these people.
And James, I'd love to really pick up on this, because what you're describing is, on one hand, the withdrawal, on the other hand, the realities of how this world rests and impacting them. But there's a fundamental here that really we're talking about in INE that has a philosophical underpinning, lived practicality, a universal code of responsibility. I'd like to talk more about how that can be lived. I'd like to talk more about not only your work down there and working with these people, but I'd like to talk about Cuba and your on-site experience there, about how INE actually emerged and how we might see it in practice, as I was describing. Let's take a short break, folks. We'll be back in a minute. James Williams with us here today. INE, I think it's a rich, rich view and foundational principle and way of thinking to bring to our considerations and integration into the commons, our way of life. Come back in a minute. Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Stop wasting time. Get what you want. Live your dream life. The Dream Big Revolution. Imagine having more freedom, better health, more money, happiness. Could your business be more successful? Unless you're living the life you want, you're wasting precious time. Your life is too valuable to waste. Let Leanne Hilgers help you find health, wealth, and happiness. Listen in and live your dream life. Join the Dream Big Revolution. Tune in every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, on the Seventh Wave Network. These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back today. Dr. James Williams, our guest. We are talking about earth-based wisdom. We're talking about heart-centered spirituality. And most importantly, we're talking about Aini. We're talking about reciprocity. We're talking about a principle of sustainability that's not just something that's over there in those people. It's in the fabric of humanity itself. It's in this web of life itself. Something that's important. And James, let's pick up maybe a little bit more. Maybe you could kind of left the last segment with some nature of the philosophical, the practical, and perhaps the spiritual. You can say a little bit more about that and bridge to the reality of the lived experience of this in Cuba, which is such a rich example of the world we may be heading into with peak oil.
Yes, Cuba is very, very interesting, and I definitely want to talk about that. The three aspects of Aini is Aini as a guiding principle, and that's mostly what we've been talking about so far in the show. That's the philosophical. It's the purpose of Aini, as I mentioned, the maintenance of life, not only individual, but it's also planetary. It's through community, it's local, and it's universal. So it's both a principle to be embraced and a practice to be lived. The practical part of Aini is daily life, that one acknowledges that everything is related from the philosophical, and that it's that because of that deeply embedded principle, not just a philosophy, but a real substantial means of navigating, moving through life between humans and nature and the planet and the biosphere and the entire universe from the indigenous point of view, because it sustains and supports us. It requires really a conscious acknowledgement and willing participation in that interconnectedness. So today I help you, tomorrow you help me, and every time we take a drink or open a bottle of wine, there's always those first drops are poured to the earth. I remember you. We contribute, we give back, we make sure that there's a flow of energy, resources, and and that it's real and practical and the here and now. The last part is the code of universal responsibility. Really, that's the spiritual part of it, that reciprocity as Aini is something that's not only an embedded code of ethics that's integral to the natural way of life, but it has a much more universal context. We'll leave those higher things for another show or perhaps another time. Let me just talk about Cuba and what I experienced in terms of the practice. Cuba is very interesting. First of all, it's one of the first islands, you know, with now the Dominican Republic and in Haiti, which was Hispaniola, and then Cuba right next to it, in the Caribbean, that the Spanish invaded, took over, colonized, and then completely turned into environmental disasters over several hundred years. They were totally forested, filled with people, and those trees have long been gone. If you go to Cuba, you see what I'm talking about. It's not the same landscape at all. So number one, the Caribbean is like a microcosm of what's happening with the rest of the planet. Number two, the Cuban social experiment, the Fidel Castro's version of Marxism, is a kind of a second aspect of the Cuban experience, and what they wanted to do is to make an equitable society, and they were succeeding until our government decided that they were doing a little bit too well. They had a 100% literacy. There's no other country in the Western Hemisphere, and I don't even believe the United States has 100% literacy. They had free medical care at a high level. They had a biotechnology, not an industry. It's a small country, but the biotechnical advances that they were making were internationally recognized at the equivalent of Sweden or Finland, very high level. And, in fact, they were the ones who discovered the vaccine for hepatitis B. Our government, of course, will never allow that to be, to be known in the media. And so they were succeeding. And then during the special period, which was embargo came on, they called it in the first time in history of the world for between 10 and 14 years, where there was a austerity during peacetime. The rest of the world was prospering under capitalism. We were squashing the small island off of our southern coast. And there are many, many complicated reasons for that. But what happened was that there was not enough gasoline. There was not enough food. There was not enough medicine. So I was there during that time. I was invited there to be there working on sustainability projects and doing grand rounds in the hospitals, and there was literally one bottle of penicillin on the entire pharmacy shelf in the National Hospital in Havana. It's really frightening. And so they got a sense of what people needed to do, how they needed to survive, and they converted their agriculture into 100% organic over time. They established all free areas that were in the city and any derelict areas that were vacant lots and into organic farming right in the center of the city. They set up pre-acupuncture clinics in every neighborhood almost, and free nursing stations in every neighborhood. So they it's something we need to do. We have it too centralized, too controlled by the monetary interest. If you want to get medicine out, if you want to get food out, you have to bring it right out to the people just the way they did it. It has to be equalized. They have to minimize the amount of shipping and trucking that has to, they can't ship from one side of the island to the other. They didn't have the vehicles. They didn't have the gasoline to do that.
So, James, now, just to pause just here for a second, but what you're painting here is a picture of some of our guests who have suggested that if we go forward and we continue with some of the breakdowns that we might be experiencing, that there is a larger context of evolution on the planet, but we have systems in breakdown, one of which is around the notion of energy and peak oil. Another is where we are heading with some of the difficulties and challenges in a financial system that's potentially overstressed, that it must grow and is reliant on energy, and we're depleting resource at the same time. But what you're describing to me, James, is a reality in this five-year period, this special period of almost a microcosm, as I was referring to before, of what just a semblance of what that life might be like, constrained in transportation and shipping, constrained in food, constrained in energy. And in the fabric of that, that's the question then. So how did then INE emerge, and what actually occurred in the community?
Let me tell you one more thing, John, is that during that period, there were no stores. I mean, every market, supermarket and things, everything was closed. There was nothing on the shelves. Everything had been used up.
Wow.
You couldn't buy a towel. So at that severe point, the third wave in Cuban history of this island being this kind of a social experiment, a microcosm for the rest of us, was that people began to have to not centralize, but decentralize. And they had to, except for the governmental control, of course, was still centralized. But in the communities, and Castro pushed this decentralization of health care, of food, and of resilience and reliability within smaller and smaller nucleus. And this is exactly how a beehive works, or how nature works. And then within those nucleus, even distinctive family units became the walls and barriers of the nuclear family, like we know them, the father, the mother, the little girl and the little boy, and the dog and the cat and the two cars in the nice garage, kind of blur. And everybody in their neighborhood becomes responsible for everybody else. The older people are cared for by your neighbor if you need to go somewhere, whether it's an afternoon or a month. Little children can run across the street and come into your house if their mother has to work or has to go to the hospital to attend to a sick relative. Everybody is caring for each other, and there's an interchange of what humans do on a daily basis, and it's not like barter so much as, I have this, you give me that, I'll trade this for that. That's the beginning of the, what we see now, a capitalistic system. This is, I need not a cup of sugar, because they didn't even have that, and a teaspoon of sugar, a tablespoon of sugar, and then you may not have any to give back at all, but then somehow you would give back something. You would come and wash clothes to some of the other neighbors, and maybe, a week later, everybody would end up, and somebody else would have black marketed a bag of sugar. Now everybody in the neighborhood is getting two teaspoons of sugar, and you might give half of yours back to the other people. They might say, "No, we don't need that now. So and so needs that." So it's something that it's hard to describe. But I live with indigenous people. When I go to Cuba, I live with the people. I'm not an outsider. I'm Spanish fluent. I navigate very well. I walk the streets, talk to the people. I have right type of licensure and everything from both governments, and I have been able to move very freely, more or less. It's still some of the totalitarian type of system that goes on there, but not in the neighborhoods at all. And I wanted to say this, right now Cuba is having as just a bad a time. Things were getting better for a while. There was, during the latter years of the Bush administration, there was lots and lots of hope that when Raul Castro came in, Obama became in, that things would change. Well, 2 years later, they are much, much, much worse for the average Cuban. Cuba, it's really, really sad. Because, again, they have nothing. There's no reason for that. The global economy has part of that problem.
Well, and so that's the reality of it, James, that there was that experience of it, the reality they are reliant on other kinds of imports and the different challenges. What you're pointing to here is the fabric of what occurred in society during this special five-year period that is so, I think, continuity and through line of our conversation, the importance of community, the coming to life of INE, this feeling of reciprocity. And those of you that listened to last week's show, we were talking about presence-centered leadership. We were talking about harmonic vibrancy in communities. It was the I, the we of all of us. That's what I'm hearing James talk about. This is a lived example, a lived presence of it. We'll come back in a minute. Let's then continue this discussion about Cuba, about the indigenous communities, how we can learn, what we can put into place. Last segment coming up in just a minute. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success, and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's AVASTONE consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back last segment today. Dr. James Williams, our guest. We're talking about Earth-Centered Wisdom. We're talking about INE. We're talking actually, I think, about the practicality of the community, the nature of the coming together that will be the fabric of the challenges and the emergence in the world, the breakthroughs, the way this will evolve as we've been talking about, new world, new human. It will take a foundation of perspective, a foundation of integration, a foundation of oneness. INE is a wonderful example of the thread of that's coming through life. It's being lived for centuries upon centuries. And in many respects in the Western world, we've lost some of this in our modern technological sense. But James, we've only got about maybe 7 or 8 minutes left here. Cuba and the special period brought people together. It's a challenging time. You're there with them. Does it live on? Does it live in the challenges of today?
Cuba, yes, it's living in the challenges there, and I think that shows us that that evolution itself. You know, when you press things down, when you scrape to the bottom, and over long periods of time, that INE is this deeply embedded principle that all things in nature, including humans, arise to. and that that when you reciprocity helps survival, and that avaristic tendencies and selfishness in the long run have helped to are destructive to survival. They benefit an individual for a short period of time, and in the long run, they the group suffers. So when people understand that, and there's a leveling, when the leader lives no better than anyone else, the great humility that's required, and I'd love to see that in here. Am I being too idealistic? You know, with our current administration, a little humility would be great. But you know, Fidel Castro maintained the same military uniform he did during the revolution. I'm not saying that he's a perfect person, but I am saying that the sense that that of humility or manifesting humility is good. I just will close on my part with that what I need teaches us. It teaches us, and I believe that. It's something that's there that we rediscover is perennial, and that it teaches us to treat each other as equals, and how what we do reflects on the earth, how we treat each other reflects on how we care for the earth. If the Gulf oil spill is a mess, then that's a reflection of how careless we are, and not just an accident, and how we care for the environment in reverse reflects how we treat each other.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, James, and just to make sure we don't lose it, those of you that are interested in reading more, Wikipedia, if you go to Wikipedia and really just look for INEAYNI, the principle of sustainability, you'll begin to get some language about this life, just as you're describing, James. But I think there's another element we can close with, and perhaps as we were talking, I used in one of the segments, talked about earth-based wisdom, heart-centered spirituality. We're not getting so much into the spirituality, but there's a heart-centered quality to this, and your work and what you're doing to bridge back the indigenous communities in South America and helping them make this transition out of where they've been locked away and now coming back, and some of the very challenging times. Maybe you could just speak to a minute about that, because I think that's a wonderful thing for people to know about the good work that you're piloting down there as well.
Yes, we've begun our own nonprofit organization, the INE Foundation, and in Peru it's INE Global, and what we're doing is we're building housing, we're putting children in school, we're archiving as much material, including DVD footage, fabrics, and as much as we can of their traditions. We're gathering the elders together. We're bringing groups down there to teach them, to train them. We're actually initiating them into the spiritual aspect, the actual path of INE, the spiritual path of INE, ancient Incan wisdom. And we're giving them for the first time in history, direct from the Karo shamans, the first initiation into INE. So, and then we teach them through workshops and then ongoing across the country. And then, of course, they work with us. They contribute, they donate their time, their money, and then we invest that into the projects that we're doing, building education, indigenous health, spiritual anthropology, and so forth. And eventually, ultimate goal is to get the Karo territory as recognized as a World Heritage Site and save as much of that wilderness as we can.
Well, it's magnificent work. It's a magnificent connection of the indigenous communities to the modern world. You know, I think it's important to recognize, James, that this is not about trying to get people to go be indigenous and live that way of life necessarily, but it's to live the principles, foundations, the enlightened view, the interconnectedness, recognizing the oneness that we are actually living through and into as a new world, a new human. James, I hear the music in the background. I'm delighted to have you on here today. You must come back and talk with us some more.
Thank you so very, very much.
Good, James, and delight, and we'll continue. James is also here with us in Sarasota, not too far from the studios, amidst all of his jaunts around the world. We're likewise in appreciation of the magnificence of the Gulf as well as the natural world. We'll continue that, as I was saying, next week. The Gulf will be our target of conversation, the Gulf and the Commons, the realities of what's occurred with this nature of the oil spill, and, as I was saying, the dead zones that we're living with in the Gulf have the agricultural communities in the Midwest. It all combines to how do we manage the commons and what are the foundations upon which we assume that responsibility and bridge beyond just a world of private sector realities and governmental sector equality. How do we bridge into that and manage the commons perhaps in a new way? That's the sovereignty we're talking about. Come join us next week as we start to bridge more into that. Out here, Zoomed, great week. James, thanks again. Enjoy, folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.